I was overwhelmed by the sense of meaning that I get from my running route and thinking about the number of people that have these other associations with the same parts of the park. And I wondered if there was a way to create an art project that held space for this amazing, multi-layered urban experience.
Composer Ellen Reed, Pulitzer Prize winner, and your musical trail guide. She created a GPS-enabled app that's like a curated soundtrack for your hike in Griffith Park. We'll hear about it later in the show. First, though, at the bakery and cafe Friends and Family in East Hollywood, you can find all sorts of delicious pastries, usually with a little twist. There are the Sonora Wheat Croissants, banana bread made with buckwheat flour, and rye flour chocolate chip cookies. Friends and Family is run by Roxana Julipat. She worked under Nancy Silverton at Campanile, then as pastry chef at Luke and AOC. But it wasn't until after those jobs that she discovered a passion for using ancient and heirloom grains in her baked goods. Now she has a new cookbook to help all of us do it too. The book is called Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. And yeah, the idea of venturing beyond the standard all-purpose flour bag may sound a little intimidating, but Roxana joined me last month to demystify the ancient grain. So when I spoke to her, I began at the beginning and asked, what exactly is an ancient grain?
Well, ancient grain is this name that we've decided to call all these species that are indeed ancient. So genetically, scientists have actually been able to trace their origins of these seeds and realize that they have been around humans for millennia. We call them ancient because they are also pretty close to the original, meaning that they haven't been modified to sort of suit our agricultural needs of the present day.
So you talk about eight of them in your book: barley, buckwheat, corn, oats, rice, rye, sorghum, and wheat. And how did you choose those eight?
So the first thing that we can say about these eight grains is that, well, like we mentioned, first of all, they are all ancient grains. So we can say that they have all played a vital role in domestic agriculture or world agriculture. But second, we can definitely say that the majority of farmers who grow these grains are doing an outstanding job of seed saving, and also in areas like land stewardship and grain husbandry. And then lastly, I could definitely say that these grains can be adequately grown in the U.S. with a lesser eco footprint. So it seems like this is eight strong major grains that cultivars stem from that we want to underline. So I call them mother grains, thinking like the way we refer to the main sauces in French cuisine, like mother sauces. These are like our mother grains.
I see. So these are the bases for all the other grain products, I guess, or grain dishes.
Sure. And this is true, especially here in the U.S. specifically, and more strongly in the U.S.
Well, why is it that we usually just use white all-purpose flour, and that's our default? It seems exotic almost to try to cook with something called sorghum. I don't even know what sorghum is. Hopefully you'll enlighten me. But before we get there, why is it that all-purpose white flour is dominant?
I mean, what's more compelling than to call an ingredient all-purpose, right? Doesn't it sound like it will solve all of your problems? And indeed, it does. It's a flour that has been designed to execute and fulfill many purposes. Indeed, it's very efficient, it's very predictable, it's also very easy to ensure its supply, right? So yes, you would say, but we have something good. Why change it? We have to question why. Where does this all-purpose come from, and what was it before it was all-purpose? And in creating that sort of like generic melting pot of flour that is just multifunctional and a solution to all and every purpose, we have missed an opportunity to really appreciate texture, flavor, history from other wheat varietals. And that's just covering wheat, right? Mm. So what if we were just pursuing a more pure form of food, like these grains that are unaltered.
Right. And so when was your aha moment? When did you think, oh, there's a whole world out there that I don't even know about? I need to go find out more about it and start cooking with these other grains. How did you come to that?
Well, there were a couple of things. I think that I always had it built in because I grew up outside of the United States. I lived all of my childhood in Costa Rica, where we eat a lot of corn products. So I had a lot of vocabulary when it came to other grains. Also, the Costa Rican diet relies heavily on rice. We eat rice pretty much for almost every single meal. So I felt like I had like more of these tools in my toolbox when it came to talking about other grains. So what became really interesting when like grains really, really knocked on my door, because it kind of like just happened to me, was the fact that I was able to I connected that grains are actually produce, that they are an agricultural product, that they do come from the field. And it was a moment in time when a few of the farmers I work with here and at the farmers market started to collect or harvest a few of the grains that they use as cover crops. And yeah, that's kind of like, it was a trickling effect. It wasn't all like, here, bag of flour, go bake something delicious. It was more like, hey, what you got there? Let's make something fun with it. And it really, really was kind of like a process rather than a bam.
All right, let's get into one of your recipes. Let's begin with chocolate chip cookies, because everyone loves a chocolate chip cookie. And probably most of us have made a chocolate chip cookie in our life.
I hope.
And most of us have used all-purpose flour when making said chocolate chip cookies. But you have recipes for all sorts of different grains, including, as I mentioned earlier, good old sorghum. Now is your opportunity to enlighten us as to the delights of sorghum and tell us what sorghum is.
Right. So because I had been a baker for so many years before I more purposefully started to incorporate grains in my baking, I had a lot of tricks. I had a lot of knowledge. I had also a lot of recipes. So I knew that there would come a moment where I would have to do one recipe that was almost good for every grain, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can prove this theory. I know I can. And I was like, okay, let's go with that quintessential bake that we all know and love and see what happens. And I think I've made this recipe with pretty much every grain that someone has put in front of me. And for sure, what was really cool about sorghum was that I was actually trying to make a gluten-free version of my chocolate chip cookie for a friend who actually cannot eat gluten. And I don't do this a lot. I don't try to reinvent my recipes as gluten-free, but sorghum is a really valuable flour when it comes to people that have gluten intolerances or celiac disease or Crohn's disease. What is really special about it is that it has a lot of texture. When it is whole grain, it actually does have a fair amount of bran and that is palatable and really actually kind of desirable. It also is a very neutral tasting flour, so meaning that it won't have a very pronounced flavor. So you can really, really just bank on the deliciousness of the chocolate and the mix of brown sugar and vanilla and let the cookie just be that.
And sorghum it's a plant, right? And it's not, it's kind of like a corn, looks like a corn plant.
Yeah. So it kind of has a little stalk that has that little, almost like a corn in the cob kind of thing, with multiple little buds at the end. Sorghum is special for many, many reasons. I call it the grain of the future because I really want to be on the PR team for sorghum. It has incredible, endless benefits in terms of sustainability, but it also is tightly woven into the culture of the South. So as a plant, it has two varietals, one that yields a grain that is used as flour or animal feed, and then another one that where the stalks are pressed to extract a juice that is then boiled down into a syrup, not unlike how we make molasses. And this sorghum syrup is a very, very popular southern ingredient. Did you know about that?
I did not.
I didn't either.
I didn't know anything about it until I started.
Yeah, I know. I didn't either until I started to research it more. And slowly, sorghum syrup has taken the place of cane sugar molasses in all of my baking.
Can you, when you're using these ancient grains, can you substitute them for the entire recipe, for the entire flour recipe? Or do you need to do like half and half or less even?
That's a great question. So the simple answer to this question is yes, you can, but you'll have to exercise good judgment, because as soon as you start learning about the properties of each individual grain, you'll notice that you'll have to make certain adjustments. So for example, buckwheat, one of my favorite ancient grains, is totally gluten-free, just like sorghum. So depending on what you are preparing with it, you might have to compensate with a little bit of a glutinous flour, like all-purpose flour, or even an heirloom wheat flour, like Sonora flour is a very popular flour here in Los Angeles, because we have a good supply of it and an excellent miller that offers it to the public.
Well, why do you do that? Why do you need gluten in your baked dishes?
So gluten at the end of the day is a protein present in a lot of grains, but specifically or especially in wheat. And it it's that stuff, that protein that allows the flour to bind. So this binding characteristic is what makes bread happen, for example, or it is what helps a cake not fall apart, right? So as a baker, you have a lot of tricks to compensate for lack of gluten, but gluten is an important element in baking.
So would you recommend what, half and half or...
I'm a big fan of half and half. But however, if you go through many of the recipes in my book, you'll find that a lot of recipes call for a full-on 100% whole grain, ancient grain flour. A great grain that serves this purpose, for example, is spelt, which I like to call a gateway flour, because it behaves very similarly to all-purpose flour. You can substitute it almost in every instance in a one-to-one fashion.
And it's a wheat. It's wheat-based, spelt.
And it's a wheat relative, yes.
Right. I have to say, it's a little intimidating just thinking about using these grains when, we're not so familiar with them and we don't know how they operate in the kitchen.
What is really cool about, and I feel like when people really lose fear about baking with whole grains, is that what's really cool about these flours is that these are flours that look different, smell different, feel different. So they are completely captivating. Like when we are baking with whole grain flours, we are fully engaged in the process. More than anything, just out of curiosity. And in doing so, every one of our senses is fully participant in the process, and it makes it a very mindful and purposeful activity. And what else could you want out of baking, if not that?
Well, you have definitely inspired me. So I'm gonna venture forth. I'm not gonna be afraid. I'm gonna try it.
You're gonna make some cake. I promise you that this will not be intimidating anymore.
Okay, good. I'm going to hold you to that. Roxana, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been super fun.
That's Roxana Julepat. She's the head baker at Friends and Family. That's a bakery in East Hollywood. And her new cookbook is called Mother Grains, Recipes for a Grain Revolution. Coming up, a selective history fully illustrated of what we eat and why. My conversation with the author of Eat This Book, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brad. Well, if you're a fan of KCRW's weekly food show, Good Food, then you're probably familiar with the work of Stacy Michelson. She's an illustrator based here in L.A. A few years ago, she took it upon herself to illustrate every episode of Good Food for an entire year. Her food drawings are bright, they're colorful, and they're a lot of fun. Now Michelson has her own book full of her food illustrations. It's called Eat This Book, Knowledge to Feed Your Appetite and Inspire Your Next Meal. It includes lots of tips and fun facts about some of the world's favorite and sometimes misunderstood foods, such as, did you know the ancient Egyptians created marshmallows? Or that until the last decade, Pizza Hut was the biggest buyer of kale? Well, that and lots of other factoids are crammed into Stacy Michelson's book. I spoke with her a couple of months ago, and I began by asking her how she learned to draw like this.
I think I just draw like this. I studied a lot of art stuff. I went to a cool high school that had screen printing and photo. I went to art school for a little bit for film, so not quite illustration stuff, but I don't know. I think I like to take notes like this in this like sketch note style. And then I just like to draw fun cartoon stuff.
And so how did you decide, okay, I'm going to marry these two things. I'm going to marry my love of drawing and cartooning into with my love of food and create a book about it?
Well, I think that started with that whole Good Food project that you mentioned in 2017, uh-huh. when I like illustrated that show. I think, you know, I'd worked in restaurants for a long time, and I was always the go-to person that would make, you know, the special signs or draw on the menu board or draw the kids menu. And I just thought, how do I do this as like a real job? Like, how do I get, you know, people to notice me to say, hey, illustrate my cookbook or something like that. So that's why I started doing that Good Food project, when I just gave myself that assignment, because I thought, you know, I'll start posting this on Instagram and it'll give me practice, but it'll also kind of show people like, hey, I think I can do this thing of, you know, having all this food knowledge, but then also the artistic skills to show you something maybe in a new way.
So what makes a good food drawing? Like, how do you know when you've really gotten it, conveyed the essence of the, let's say, pear or fig?
So like for this book, I think there's a couple parts. Like I do all the research, and then in my sketchbook, as I'm researching it, I'll circle something or I'll put something that I really think, you know, like in this whole book, there's a lot of talk bubbles. So those are things like in the way that I would just tell you if you were sitting next to me, like if you were there and I was like, oh, Madeline, look at this. And I would say, you know, I'd pull out a quote and I'd draw a talk bubble around it and kind of start forming my page like that. But then there has to be like a clever way to display the title. So like for Nopales, like I do that in the actual cactus to show the little cactus pears on the ends, like to write out that name. And then I think overall, just if at the end, I want to like take a picture of it and send it to some of my friends and be like, look at this drawing. Then I think, okay, I think that's a good drawing. I think that's good enough for the book. I can stop, right?
You actually grew up in a food family.
Correct.
Right? Your dad and grandpa were produce buyers and exporters?
Yeah. And so like I'm from Huntington Beach down in Orange County, but my grandparents lived in LA. My parents are from LA. And that was just, yeah, like the Michelson business. And so I always just knew, you know, all these fresh fruits and vegetables that my dad would bring home or that I'd have at my grandparents' house. And that was just, I don't know, that was totally normal to me. And a lot of my friends, I'd like give them something like a taste of something for the first time. I think, you know, they'd be like, hey, can your dad get me more of those caramel apple things? Or can you bring home artichokes or mangoes or, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah. So that was, I mean, we weren't a restaurant family or anything, but I think being exposed to all the produce was really cool.
So you knew how to eat an artichoke and you knew how to cut a mango.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. The mango thing with, you know, you score it and then you flip it inside out like a little porcupine. Uh-huh. Like that was my favorite. So like in the book, I try to do a lot of little, you know, like stories or fun facts about them, but also little useful tips like that. Like, here's how you prep an artichoke, or here's how you're going to prep your mango, or, you know, pick a fig when it's really heavy for its size. You know, those kind of little things that maybe some people instinctively know or you're taught, and other people are just like, I don't even know like when, like what I'm looking for when I go to the market, you know?
So the book is filled with illustrations, sassy drawings, great art, but also lots of fun facts that I had no idea about. So, for instance, I had no idea that, well, let's start talking about the avocado, that every single Haas avocado can be traced to one single tree here in Southern California. What's the story?
Yeah, I know. And how crazy is that? So in La Habra, I mean, that poor tree, it was the mother tree. It passed away in 2002. But like when I found that out, I was thinking, wait, like every avocado, you know, of the, some people say Haas, some people say Haas. I haven't talked to that family. I don't know, but I think it's Haas. But that every tree, you know, avocado can be traced to that tree. That's so crazy. And he was just a postal worker. Like it wasn't even, you know, an avocado farmer.
Mr. Haas or Haas?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yeah, he was a postal worker, and then he patented that in 1935. And then that became, that kind of like knocked the Fuerte avocado out because it was creamier. It was more durable for shipping because it has that thicker, you know, pebbly skin. It had a longer growing season. So like when I read those kind of things, I'm thinking, man, I feel like everybody needs to know that story, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So then like those things, I'm like, okay, that makes it in the book for sure.
For sure. So why does that pebbly skin, why is that the one that takes over? The Haas or Haas?
Because that's more durable in shipping. Like if you see a Fuerte, it's, you know, it's a thinner.
It's the smooth skin, the greeny smooth skin. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's so many things like with fruits where I feel like, and, you know, produce in general, where I feel like the, you know, the thing that's just going to hold up better in shipping, like it might not be the tastiest thing, but that's the thing that just becomes the most common because, hey, they can ship it. It lasts longer on the shelf. You know, I mean, there's so many fruits, especially here in California, like say like loquats, like those are not in my book, but just for instance, like you never see those at the store, but like there's trees all down my street that are loquat.
Yeah.
So it's like some things just don't hold up, you know, with the whole package, like packing and shipping and all that.
Okay, let's talk about the marshmallow. That thing, that just blew my mind because here I was thinking that this was just some kind of vile chemical experiment, but it is, its history goes back a couple of thousand years. Can you give us a little primer on the marshmallow?
Yeah, well, so the marshmallow, like, you know, that name, for instance, like it just sounds fun. It sounds squishy. It sounds like it describes it, right? But the actual mallow plant grew in marshes. So that's where that name comes from. Like it's from a plant. So like that kind of thing, you know, like when I just read that, or maybe I can't remember where I first got interested in that, but it's like, you know, you see something or I'll hear a podcast and somebody will like mention something like that about the name, like, oh yeah, it's named after a plant. And then it's kind of like, wait, excuse me. And then I become like this food detective. And then I'm like on the internet and I'm watching videos and all this stuff. And then it's like, yeah, it's this ancient thing, like ancient Egyptians, they mixed the mallow sap with honey. And it was like this food only for the gods. And they used it for all sorts of things from, you know, like a love potion to cure sore throats and coughs, that kind of thing. And it's like, that was the original, you know, marshmallow type thing. But then once it got into French candy stores, they replaced the mallow sap with gelatin. And then it became, you know, more like the modern marshmallow we know now, which doesn't contain any mallow sap. But like that whole story is so interesting. So it's like, I don't know. I feel like once you hear something like that, you can't forget it. And then it changes your, like you appreciate the marshmallow a little bit more, you know? And then I also threw something on that page that was about the Girl Scouts. Do you remember that part?
Yeah.
So like s'mores, right? It's like, you know, we all know that, but that was the first published recipe that used marshmallows. It was like in the 20s.
So Girl Scouts came up with that.
Yeah.
And they called it a s'more?
Yeah, they called it s'more. And then, yeah, it was that morphed into s'mores.
Let's talk about liquid smoke because, again, like the marshmallow, I thought it was just a bunch of noxious chemicals created by a corporation to imitate the smell and taste of smoke. But in fact, it actually is smoke.
It is.
How is it created? How do you bottle smoke?
Well, okay, so that one, so just a fun little story about the book that I think is cool is a lot of people have, when I started posting these on Instagram, like originally before it was a book idea, a lot of people were like, can you do this? Can you explore this? Can you, you know, be a food detective on this one? And liquid smoke was one that a couple people were like, can you tell me what that is? Because like you said, it's like people don't really know what it is or how it's made. And everybody thinks it's just a chemical thing, you know, but it's actually real smoke that's made from condensation. So it's like wood chips, sawdust that's burned inside a chamber. And then that smoke rises and then it's captured. And then when it cools, all these little water droplets form. So it's like it's a collection basically of the condensation, and then it's filtered and concentrated and then bottled. So it's nothing crazy. It's actually just what it says, liquid smoke.
So what would you put it on if you used it? I've never used it.
Oh, well, I have a bottle that's probably way past its expiration, but it's still totally good. But it flavors anything you want to taste. Like maybe you've cooked greens, like a pot of greens, with something like, you know, give it that smoky taste. Like if you would use a piece of ham, like, so a lot of vegetarians use it for stuff like that. But also just in barbecue sauce, like it's in barbecue sauce as an ingredient. And then the majority of liquid smoke that's used is actually the stuff that's in all the processed meats that you buy. So in hot dogs and lunch meats and bacon and cheese, like a lot of those things, those labels also, like I was super shocked to find out that if it just labels an ingredient as smoke, that could be, it's actually smoked in a smoker, or it could be liquid smoke. Like there's not really a,
really
anything that says, yeah. So it's kind of murky, like that definition of like when you just see smoked, blah, blah, blah.
So he's like a hickory smoked bacon is maybe just bacon with liquid smoke.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
So then like also when you just add, like it's also kind of one of those things that can totally transform your dish. So like a lot of times if I'm making a pot of beans or greens or something like that, like I'll just do one or two little drops and all of a sudden it's just like, holy cow, like, why is this so good? And it's like that magic bottle that's been sitting in the back of your cupboard forever.
Huh. I do have a question about the illustration.
Okay.
So on one of the hands that's holding the bottle of liquid smoke in your illustration, there's some writing on the hand. It says, pick up onions, call mom, laundry. So it was like a list of to-do things written on the hand.
Yeah, that was really on my hand that day when I made that, when I made that page.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I always write on my hand. I'm like, you know, like 13. But I always write on my hands like little things. And I feel like, you know, all these pages were just ways that I can, you know, just tell stories and whatever. So I thought like, you know, I'm going to hide that really small. Like I'm surprised that you saw that, but it's like, you know, it's really faint on there, but just writing those couple little like notes, then also like, I'm sure my mom will be like, oh my God, you were thinking of me, you know, so I'll get points with my mom. It'll be great. But also just, it's fun to like all through this book, you know, there's little things that I hid, little messages, like, you know, people call them Easter eggs. But like, mm-hmm. I put those all over the book, and it's just, I think it's fun because you can't, you know, it's like, you'll maybe notice it on the second or the third, you know, pass when you're looking at something or, yeah, I don't know. And I'm the hand model in almost all of these drawings also. So, yeah.
Okay. You do it all. You are a one woman band.
Exactly.
Well, check out Stacy's new book. It's called Eat This Book, Knowledge to Feed Your Appetite and Inspire Your Next Meal. Stacy Michelson, thank you.
That was the best. Thank you, Madeline Brand.
Coming up, from eating to drinking, Evan Kleiman and I share some hard cider and get a little tipsy. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Greens.
salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes, Bake Off Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
It's Memorial Day, and I don't know about you, but I think today is a perfect day for an adult beverage. Hard cider has seen a boom in California over the past decade. And lucky me, Evan Kleinman delivered some samples to me to my house a couple of months ago so we could go on a cider tasting tour together, apart, of course. Evan hosts KCRW's Good Food. Hi, Evan. You have provided me with four beautiful ciders by the looks of things.
Yes, absolutely. This is a tasting of hard ciders, so all of these are alcoholic. And while we're talking, why don't we go ahead and open our first one?
Okay, we're having a taste test. This is very exciting for me.
Okay, let's pour a little.
Oh.
Mmm. So I don't think we can drink without saying cheers to one another. L'chaim.
Zdrovia. Okay, I'm going to taste this one. Lassen.
Yeah, this is the Lassen Filigreen Farm Single Orchard Dry Cider.
It's really good. It's tart.
Yeah, it's tart. It has a little bit of natural carbonation. It's crisp. Oh, I think it's quite delicious.
I would definitely drink this on a hot summer day, for sure.
Yeah, and I think most ciders are extremely food friendly. So because of the tart nature of many of them, I would say that they go really well with a lot of the foods that we're eating these days, spicy food, food that has just a ton of flavor. I think this is, you know, it's going to clear your palate and set you up for the next bite.
Mm. All right. Before we get into these individual ciders and how they were made, let's talk in general. How do you make an apple cider? What are they?
So cider is made much like wine. Fresh juice, in this case, apple juice, is fermented. And from there, depending upon what the cider master decides to do, you have a bunch of styles that are similar to wine. Some cideries add yeast or sugar. Some ferment the juice until it's bone dry. Others stop the fermentation to allow for a bit more sweetness. Some is bottle conditioned, which is what we're drinking now, which means that either yeast or a little fresh apple juice or maybe both are added to the fermented juice in the bottle so that it effervesces while it's in the bottle. And then there's Pet Nat, which is a really big thing. That's AKA Petillon Naturel, or natural effervescence that is created by bottling the cider before the fermentation is completed. And I will say that as with beer currently, there's a love of sour in ciders, which is easy to create with either wild apples or wild fermentation. And the great thing about cider is that the alcohol range, for the most part, is lower than most wines we're drinking these days.
So you can drink more of it.
Yeah, you can drink it and not get, you know, wasted. For me, it's a perfect thing to have with a meal. This one that we're having is a little bit high. It's 8.6% ABV. The apples themselves are from Boonville, California, and the cidery is in Chico, which is north of Sacramento. And the apple variety is the Newton Pippin. It's one of the oldest apple cultivars in the U.S. And this cultivar was originally discovered in Queens, New York in the 1700s.
Oh, my gosh. And do you have to make cider with apples? Can you do it with any other fruit?
Well, it's called something different if you make it with other things. Pear is called perry. If there's honey in the mix, then it's mead. But basically, what's going on in California is people are really looking to the land and the terroir and things around them. So, for example, the next one we're going to be tasting, the Ambith Estate, is of Golden Delicious and quince.
Oh, okay. This is Ambith?
Ambith Estate. Okay. 75% apples, 25% quince.
Mmm.
This one is a lot more, what's the word, full-bodied, I guess?
I would say savory.
Yeah, it's good. Earthy,
oh, it's
I would
really
call
good.
It.
Yes, earthy, but without being funky.
There's something kombucha-esque about these ciders.
Yes, and that's really interesting because a lot of cider makers make kind of hybrids, something that is a hard cider but is also a booch. So I think the next one we're going to try falls into that category. That's the 101 Cider House Sour Cider Sunlit, and it's made with hops and grapefruit peels.
And it comes in a can.
And this one comes in a can.
Okay.
This is a Los Angeles cidery.
Yeah, this one tastes exactly like kombucha. Usually I down a whole bottle of kombucha, but I wouldn't want to do that here because then, well, I'd be drunk.
Well, this is 6.9 ABV, which is kind of low. It's higher than a kombucha, but it's kind of low. If you like IPAs or natural wines, this veers in that direction. But once again, don't you think it's pretty accessible, this one?
Absolutely. I could definitely down this whole can, and maybe not advisable during the workday. But, you know.
That's true.
As soon as we're done talking, you know, I'll finish this off.
And then we have one last one, which is made from a cidery in San Luis Obispo, Durham Cider and Wine Company. They're so interesting to me because the cidery is in San Luis Obispo, but they source apples from really incredible, kind of famous farms all over the state. So these particular apples are from the Anderson Valley up north. They're dry farmed at a 140-year-old orchard called Gowans in Philo, California. And this is 65% Gravenstein, which is the famous Sonoma County apple. And then it also has 35% rhubarb. Have you tasted it yet?
I'm going to taste it right now. That really has a sour kick to it. It's almost like a Sour Patch Sour Patch candy.
But they call it a semi-dry. When you first put it in your mouth, it has a hint of sweetness, I think. And this rhubarb is organic from Trevino Farms in Surf, California. And it's really low in alcohol, pretty much. It's 5.7.
So this is why it's called Rubenstein, because it's half rhubarb, half Gravenstein.
Right. Rubenstein as in R-H.
That's really clever.
Yeah, and all the, as with wine, all the labels are fantastic. I just think it's another genre of alcoholic beverage to sort of fall into and learn about. I was helped along the way choosing these, by the way, by Lou Amder from Lou Wine Shop.
Mm-hmm.
And from George Cassette and Greg Peters over at Silver Lake Wine. So we had their inventory to choose from.
Which is your favorite, if you could pick one?
Maybe the very first one, the Lassen. What about you?
I like the 101.
Oh, that's so interesting. You're such a rebel. It's very thirst-quenching, this stuff.
I wish we could do it in person, but...
That will happen soon. And I'm so happy that we got to do this together.
Me too. Wow. And now I've got all this stuff to drink. Okay. Talk to you later.
Bye.
That's Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. All right, all that eating, we need some exercise now. My conversation with a composer who created a custom soundtrack for hiking the trails in Griffith Park. That conversation next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, picture yourself in Griffith Park on a hike up to the observatory. You hear people talking, the jingle of a dog on a leash, birds chirping, the crunch of your shoes. Well, as you make your way up the trail, a chorus of voices swells. Underneath, the faint sound of heavy breathing, almost in sync with your own breathing. And then the strums of a harp come in. The music is created by composer and sound artist Ellen Reed. She has scored more than 20 miles of trails throughout Griffith Park for her app, Ellen Reed Soundwalk. The way it works, you download the app on your phone before heading out to the park. Once you're at the trailhead, you hit play. And the music is GPS enabled, meaning what you hear at any given point along your hike is based on your specific location in the park. It's kind of like a curated soundtrack for your walk. She launched the project in New York's Central Park last year, and she has more sound walks in the works. Ellen Reed has also won a Pulitzer Prize back in 2019 for her debut opera, Prism. And she joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Well, it's so great to have you. And I'm really excited to try this out on my own hike up Griffith Park. But how did you come up with this idea of scoring outdoor walks?
You know, I love being outside, and taking walks in parks is a big part of my process. And a few years ago, about 2 years ago, I was taking a jog in Prospect Park, and I was overwhelmed by the sense of meaning that I get from my running route, and thinking about the number of people that have these other associations with the same parts of the park. And I wondered if there was a way to create an art project that held space for this amazing multi-layered urban experience that exists in parks through time. And I wanted to create a soundtrack that illuminated the landscape and made space for your own personal experience.
So your first project was Central Park.
Yeah, that's where we premiered it. Mm-hmm.
And how does Griffith Park differ? And the two parks couldn't be more different, right?
I totally,
mean, just
yeah,
how,
right.
How designed Central Park is and how undesigned Griffith Park is.
Yeah, I mean, Central Park is basically a big composition. You know, Olmsted, the architect, designed this well-crafted park where as you walk through it, it's melodic in ways. And as you said, Griffith Park couldn't be more different. But then the stunning, incredible beauty of being so close to the sky and the vistas that you get in Griffith is just next level, you know? So it was really different where... Also, it's really strenuous to hike in Griffith Park. So kind of the things I was playing with in Griffith Park were about endurance and about the challenges of climbing uphill and then the vistas. And like, how can those things work together into a soundscape that supports what you're doing, but leaves space for whatever's happening around you?
Well, speaking of steep climbs, let's play one of your songs on this. It's called Steep Burning Ascent. My breath. Finishing the hike.
Totally. Yeah. I think you can catch the idea about that piece. Yeah. So that piece, not to be a huge spoiler alert, is at this really steep incline right before you get to the observatory. If you're coming from the observatory loop trails, you feel like you're almost at the observatory and there's this gorgeous vista, and then you turn around and it's like, oh. There's this super steep incline, and so that's your soundtrack up that incline.
Oh yeah, I know that. I know that well. That is really kind of torturous, I will say that.
But the payoff, you know?
Yeah, the payoff is fantastic.
Yeah.
It sure is. And you're so proud of yourself once you finally scrambled up there.
Right.
How did you compose this? Did you compose it as you were hiking around? Was the music coming to you in your head?
I'm trying to think about how to describe how I composed this. So I had to compose this in a totally different way than I've ever had to compose anything, because there's so many different experiences that you can have in the park. So somebody might walk one way on the trail and the other somebody else might walk another way on the trail. Somebody might just cross through this part of the trail, and no matter how people intersect with the music, it has to make sense for their journey. So I had to create this kind of spider web of connective tissue that works mm-hmm. musically across the whole park. And also with Griffith, it was challenging because most people will leave from their car and then go back to their car. So that means that they can't mm-hmm. be bored if they go up and down the same trail. So the way that I wrote the music was I built a lot of kind of micro scenarios of what the music could sound like and just walked them and logged miles and miles and miles of walking, just testing the material in different ways. And then I programmed it without being in the park. Just I did a rough draft of what I thought it would be like. And then I went to the park and walked all of the routes. And, you know, inevitably when you're walking it, things change and you see things. And the moment when you catch a view of the Hollywood sign is such an impactful moment on the trail. So that's where that note needs to come in. And just like finding those details was something that happened like on the ground in the park.
Right. And I can imagine how challenging that is because, as you say, some people will race up the hill. Some people will stroll, amble. I mean, there are different speeds. So when you want to get that payoff at the end, like how do you orchestrate that for everybody?
It has to be elastic. And I always say the music in this is kind of like a kaleidoscope where there are all these different parts that kind of tumble around and arrange themselves depending on your pace and kind of where you hit those certain points. So yeah, it's a really different way of having to think about music than a concert experience or scoring a film or something where there's this very controlled experience and people are locked into this amount of time.
Right. And you have to imagine how they're receiving it because you don't see the audience.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And there's actually no way to try all the different paths. You can try two, and then you have to just guess that the other three are going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit from another composition. This one is called West Coast Sky Forever. Would we hear this? Where would we be in the park when we hear this music?
There are a few places that this music comes up. One spectacular place is on your way up to the Captain's Roost, and this is the soundtrack of the Captain's Roost. Also, if you're going up the Brush Canyon Trail, I have the song as an Easter egg at this really beautiful bench where you can sit and just look out over the canyon. I'm so glad you wanted to play this track. I'm super proud of this piece. It's the beautiful Kronos Quartet, who is a featured performer of this soundwalk in LA. And this is all new. It was written for Griffith Park. And I love the spirit and the, you know, experimental boldness that Kronos Quartet brings to this project.
It is a very pandemic-friendly project. Is this in part how you came up with this idea?
Yes, I came up with the idea before the pandemic, and we were trying to bring it into existence, and we were planning on launching it in a few years. And then when the pandemic hit, we kind of just got together and thought, this is a project that can happen, people can do it, and you can do it fully right now. So the way that you're supposed to do this project is solo and with headphones. So it's so great to have a project that can be experienced in its full manifestation right now. So yeah, the idea came before the pandemic, but definitely the fire to move ahead with it quickly happened because of the pandemic.
What's your next park, your next walk that you're going to score?
Oh, we have a bunch, and I don't actually know which one I'm doing next. We have one at Wolf Trap, which we're really excited about, two at Virginia Arts Festival, and a whole bunch that are going to happen this spring, and still a lot are kind of in the works. We're getting requests and figuring out where we can figure out to do them.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I can't wait to go out by myself and listen to your music as I'm walking. It sounds delightful.
Yay.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I'm really excited. If you want any trail recommendations, just let us know. But hope it works well for you, and hope you have a great hike.
What's your favorite trail? What's your favorite trail to do with this music?
You know, they all have different different things. If you want a trail that hits a lot of the best things, if you take the Charlie Turner Trail past the George Harrison Tree up to the Captain's Roost, you'll get a lot of different things. And then you also get the observatory soundtrack, and so you get all that, which is, you know, it's a nice hike, and you have a bunch of different sounds that happen on that trail. So I highly recommend that one, but you know, they each have their own things. So yeah, can't go mm-hmm. wrong.
Try them all. Try all.
Try them all.
Exactly. Maybe not all at once, but
yeah, right. Oh my gosh, I know, right? My health app after I tested this was like, excuse me, like 12 miles a day. One day it was like 131 flights of stairs.
Oh my gosh, you must have been in great shape when you were doing this.
Yeah, well, that was a few weeks ago, so trust me, I've just been eating cookies since then.
That's composer Ellen Reed, and if you want to listen to her music while walking through Griffith Park, her app is Ellen Reed Soundwalk. It's a free app to download, and Reed is spelled R-E-I-D, Ellen Reed Soundwalk. Her project is presented by UCLA Center for the Art of Performance. Well, that does it for a special Memorial Day edition of Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever, wherever you want, maybe on that hike after you listen to Ellen Reed's soundtrack. Find us at kcw.com/pressplay. Big thanks to Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Michelle Aloy, and Sarah Sweeney, of course. Have a safe, happy holiday, and I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you.